Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's January 29, 2014, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and joining me today are colleagues Mike McKean and Jim Flink. We've got a lot to talk about in the next half hour. Ryan Ferguson is back in the news, this time trying to drum up support for Amanda Knox, the woman accused of killing her roommate while studying abroad in Italy a few years ago. We'll look at the way that the major news networks covered Justin Bieber's arrest last week. I can tell you right now, at least one of the gentlemen sitting beside me has some pretty strong feelings on this one. And a New York congressman threatens a reporter with physical violence after an interview after last night's State of the Union address. But let's start with the story that has Mid-Missouri and much of the nation talking. Friday afternoon, ESPN's Outside the Lines published the results of its investigation into the suicide of swimmer Sasha Manucori. According to the ESPN report, in February 2010, after a night out drinking with friends, Corey said she went home with a former football player and had consensual sex. Months later, she told a rape crisis counselor and wrote in a journal that after the man left, another football player entered the room, locked the door, and raped her.
Sasha did not report the incident to police, nor did Woodland, who says he later saw a video the men recorded of the alleged rape. The day after it happened, he says Sasha began to contemplate taking her own life.
She started to talk about, if something ever happened to me, Landis, you know, don't be sad. And I was like, Sasha, man, don't talk like that. You know, like, everything's going to be fine. What are you talking about?
2 months later, Sasha checked herself into the campus hospital for one night, saying she had suicidal thoughts. Teen doctors began refilling her prescriptions for an antidepressant and sedative. She started seeing therapists and later told the athletic department about her hospitalization for a major depressive disorder.
Soon after that, Corey was removed from the swim team and sunk into deeper despair. She checked herself into University Hospital again, saying she was having suicidal thoughts, and after 10 days was released to the care of her parents and attempted suicide, slitting her wrists while in a Columbia hotel room. At that point, her parents had her admitted to a hospital in Boston for therapy, where she got her hands on a bottle of Tylenol and swallowed 100 pills. 2 days after that, she died. The ESPN investigation claims university officials knew about the sexual assault and did not act. Since this weekend's report, the university has turned over all of its records to the Columbia Police Department, and university president Tim Wolf called for an independent investigator. ESPN's story, when viewed on its own, doesn't paint the university or the athletic department in a very good light. But there's a lot more to this story than what you see just in Outside the Lines.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's just a tragedy all the way around. And it's a very complicated story, at least as we've seen it played out so far. So it's a good thing that there is going to be an investigation. Who knows what, if anything, can actually be dug up after a few years. There's some key elements to it. You know, for example, what is the staffer who used to work for MU and was supporting her? You know, what is she going to ultimately say? So far, all she's done is denied that Sasha told her in a phone call about the rape. I think finding out what she has to say is going to be pretty important. And then this whole timeline about when the athletic department knew about it and how quickly they responded to it is going to be interesting, too. I'm not so sure that some of the quick conclusions that people have drawn in the national media about this story are going to ultimately hold up. I don't know how much the university is accountable for this, but I am glad that this story is causing us to have a renewed conversation about sexual assault on campuses and how athletic departments tend to respond to them.
I don't think there's any question about it. I mean, I think one of the things that's going to come out of this, and all the details you point are very salient, is you know, I don't think we can assume that that students that arrive at the university necessarily, I think we just think of them as kids, but I think we need to recognize that these issues of needing psychological services is one issue, and the need and the understanding that we at this university have just gone through training on the issue of psychological health and how it plays into the whole role. Then I think there's going to be an issue of what is communicated to whom, when, within these departments. You know, she did avail herself to psychological services. She did avail herself to medical services. But, you know, with all of the protections and privacy that comes with that, what they were able to, not just what are they mandated to, but what are they able to communicate with whom in this situation may have changed a number of variables here. And so this is going to lead to a lot of discussion that is, to your point, Mike, very important to have about the psychological health. And then we get to the issue of underreporting of rape and how prevalent this is on college campuses and what universities are proactively going to do about this, because it is not a problem that's going away. You know, one in five women in college are reportedly raped. Only 12% of those report the rape. And so we have this this need to discuss the health of the college community and how we communicate.
And it's actually something that the Obama administration in the last 10 days or so has indicated is going to be a priority in trying to create a healthier atmosphere to do that.
Yeah, and you know, truthfully, the whole issue of when university officials and which university officials can talk about this is really important too. I mean, I would agree with Jim. I mean, I think the healthcare professionals, the mental health professionals, there are lots of roadblocks for them to report this kind of behavior, unless the victim allows them to. But the crux is whether or not an athletic department staffer knew or not. And if she knew, who did she tell? And there's just a lot of time. If you look at the timeline in the ESPN story, there's some holes in there that are kind of hard to explain on the surface of it. Why did it take so long after the athletic department discovered, in looking at the emails following Sasha's suicide, to tell the family that, you know, it's up to you to let us know whether or not you'd like us to, you know, have a police investigation of this? And there are other things like that too. It's just, it's unfortunate, I think, that the university, well, I don't know who's going to ultimately be to blame for this, if anybody, but it's unfortunate that the university already has a black eye. Its credibility on this is not very good after the way they handled the Michael Dixon case with the basketball squad a couple of years ago. Clearly, in that instance, the coach and others knew about allegations of sexual assault against a player, and they did nothing to take him off the team until the media blew it up. So that's just unfortunate.
And to that point, Mike, I was talking with Mark Horvitt from Investigative Reporters and Editors just a little bit about this today. And he said, you know, the Columbia Tribune did some reporting on this a while back. And maybe that was the time to launch this investigation that has now ensued with the Columbia Police Department. That investigation may find that nothing improper was done in this whole process. But it also may find something else. But, you know, to the point of proactively, you know, if you hear wind of something, do you need to, as an administrator, whether it be in the athletic department or somewhere else, do you need to push that further and say, do we need to find out more about this, rather than saying we don't know enough and we can't know? Maybe that's the time to go proactive. And that is presumptuous to say the least, but it's a question that will be asked.
And here's a question that concerns me. I mean, the Tribune ran a story 7 months after Sasha committed suicide. And way down in that story, there were two sentences that made reference to how she'd written in her journal about sexual assault. Did the Tribune follow up with that? I don't know. Allegedly, the story was faxed to the athletic department. But again, those two lines in that story don't tell you very much unless somebody digs deeper. And I kind of wish that the Tribune and others in the media had dug deeper at that point.
And if I could add one last thing, you know, this is where television investigative reporting can do, can launch a lot of questions, but they can't get to all the answers because of the limitations of time. And I think that is the difficulty in looking at this in just a 16-minute piece and a supporting piece is it just opens so many more questions that you wish you had answers to.
Well, maybe in time we'll get some of those. Remember Amanda Knox, the former college student who's accused of, with her boyfriend, killing her roommate in Italy? Well, she's being retried for that crime, and the verdict is expected to come down almost any time now. That story now has a mid-Missouri connection. Knox's newest friend, Ryan Ferguson.
I've known about her for quite some time. And whenever I got out, she obviously on Free Ryan Ferguson, you know.
Yeah, I think we have the picture she posted of saying, "Welcome home, welcome back, Ryan." Yeah.
Yeah, and she wrote a letter. And so we kind of had this connection in the sense that we've been through this justice system, although hers was in Perugia, mine's here. It's relatively the same. And we've been through this, and there's not a whole lot of people in this world who have dealt with wrongful conviction. So it's cool. We could just kind of talk to each other. And really, she wanted to reach out and just say, look, if you need to talk to anybody, if you need any help, I'm here for you. If not, I completely understand. And so that's how we began communicating.
Ferguson is taking up Knox's case, trying to drum up support in the court of public opinion ahead of that verdict. Ferguson is quickly becoming an advocate for people who are either on trial in situations where he believes there may have been a wrongful conviction in appeals. A surprise here that Knox and Ferguson have had this bond?
It almost seems inevitable. And, you know, I mean, Ryan Ferguson has 10 years of his life to catch up on and trying to rationalize all these things that happened to him and look for a way forward. You know, if he wants to help other people he believes have been wrongly convicted or accused, well, good for him. It's also not surprising that the media would be all over this story because Amanda Knox, you know, how much time did she command when her trial in Italy was going on, the first one? So this story is just too good to
pass
up.
It even resulted in a Lifetime movie.
Yeah, there is certainly the celebrity to it. And maybe that's not such a bad thing because I think, you know, there are many lawyers and law schools who have dedicated teams to trying to find these cases of wrongfully convicted folks. And in some respects, they've sort of lived in this secondary tier of attention. And here you have two people who have lived the 24/7 news cycle who through probably reluctantly have become the face of this issue. And so if they combine and they lend credence to continuing to look at that, that may not be such a bad thing. And maybe a lot of people win out of that.
Okay, the next story I want to touch on, well, we might end up debating whether it even is a story. Early Thursday morning, teen pop star Justin Bieber was arrested in Florida for drag racing. He was also charged with driving under the influence. For the cable news networks, this was a big deal. See how big.
Not Congresswoman Harmon, let me interrupt you. Congresswoman, let me interrupt you just for a moment. We've got some breaking news out of Miami. Stand by if you will. Right now in Miami, Justin Bieber has been arrested on a number of charges. The judge is reading the charges, including resisting arrest and driving under the influence. He's appearing now before the judge for his bond hearing. Let's watch.
They had been talking about issues of national security, and Jon Stewart had a thing or two to say about that. Here he is on The Daily Show.
They're not booing, they're saying, Boober. You interrupted a former congresswoman, a national security expert, for something Justin Bieber did? Unless Justin Bieber caused an earthquake in Japan, I doubt it was worth it. But still, the media flooded the zone for Bieber's drag racing arrest, with CNN in particular pulling out all the stops, with a special report, footage literally lifted from TMZ, testimony from at least three former child stars, and state-of-the-art CGI simulations.
When he raced against a Ferrari on a quiet residential stretch of the beach, both vehicles nearly twice the speed limit, two black SUVs blocking the roadway.
When suddenly Yoshi hit a Koopa shell, and then who shows up? Pac-Man, just in time to beat up some hookers. Oh, the humanity! Ah! Point is, what a terrible idea of coverage.
Point well made, really. And not just that, but you're cutting off the congresswoman in half sentence. Like, no, you have to stop right now because we have to get to the Biebs because that's much more. Really? I mean, this kid has been in the news for all sorts of, he's a juvenile. And some might say, lately has been acting more juvenile, delinquent, and yet you're discussing national security. I do not understand. We were talking before the show began. I'll bet you Andrea Mitchell had a few words to say to the producer or the director, both of whom were in her ear saying, we need to go to the breaking news. No, we don't need to go to the breaking news. We need to evaluate what is breaking news. And for me, not. Sorry.
Does it anger me? Yes. Does it surprise me? No. I mean, just let's just be honest. I mean, Justin Bieber, anything he does, we're going to make news, partly because the media are fascinated with the story, largely because the audience is fascinated with the story. And it's that kind of classic prisoner's dilemma. First one that doesn't do it, the others have got the coverage and the clickers are out and people are watching the other channel. Only one of the cable 24-hour cable news networks in the United States could resist, and that was Al Jazeera America, which has, what, maybe 40, 50,000 people watching at any one time. They decided not to carry
and to promote it. Al Jazeera America committed at its launch not to give in to some of those more prurient stories, some of those sensational things, not to become a talking head, screaming
head. And how many
network.
Viewers do they have, and how much advertising revenue are they generated, and would they even still be on the air if the royal family of Qatar was not bankrolling?
And while I don't disagree with that, there is a moment where that anchor has the opportunity to, frankly, pull that IFB, that earpiece, out of her ear and to say, we do have some breaking news we want to get to, or just to say, you know what, and unless you switch, I'm going to hang until this congresswoman finishes her point on the NSA, and rather than breathlessly cutting away in mid-sentence, now we'll make a transition to say, hold that thought. I want to talk more with you for in a second, but we do have something that some of our viewers will find important. And so it is how you couch that breaking news and that you don't just breathlessly say, because somebody's talking in my ear or because somebody told me I need to cut away because they knew this was coming. Do it just a little bit more in a disciplined manner.
I think, though, that Andrea Mitchell or anybody else in that situation would have had to do something very dramatic, like pull out the earpiece and say, we're not going to do this right now. We'll tell you a little bit later about – because unless there's a YouTube clip of it that's getting tweeted and retweeted and shared all through social media, it's going to have no impact. Mm-hmm. So the anchor herself would have had to make a dramatic moment in order to rescue that situation.
Well, let's go back to some real news, something a little bit heavier. Last night's State of the Union address. Anything in there stand out to you next day?
For me, it was very clearly that the president said, you know, I'm not standing with this Congress. I'm standing in spite of this Congress. I'm going to do everything I can to proceed in my vision with executive power. And that's where we live.
You know, it just struck me that, you know, ever since Bill Clinton's, what, hour and 20-something minute address back in the day, that every president has to have a laundry list of things, most of which are not very big, and whether or not they're implemented aren't going to make that much difference. I do think that, as all the prognosticators said going into it, he was going to treat immigration differently than his other conflicts with the Republicans in the House, and he did, and maybe something will come of that.
Okay, well, for local media, covering the State of the Union is often about getting reaction from local representatives. That's what New York One's Michael Scotto was trying to do, talking to Staten Island Congressman Michael Grimm last night. Only when Scotto tried to take the interview into a slightly different direction and ask Grimm about an investigation into his campaign finances, the congressman wouldn't have it.
Let me be clear to you. You have to do that to me again.
I just wanted to ask you.
Grimm has since apologized for threatening to break him in half like a little boy, and Scotto has indicated he won't be pressing charges, but initially the congressman defended that behavior, saying he wasn't the first to tell off a reporter and likely wouldn't be the last. It's one thing for there to be a little bit of give and take between reporters and their sources, especially politicians, but this crossed the line.
when you threaten to throw somebody off of a balcony and to break their neck, I mean, which is what that would do, or to break them in half. This is a threat. This is way over the line. It's not the first time that this has happened with this particular congressman. He's under investigation for the very thing that the reporter wanted to talk to him about. Was it the right time or the right place? You know, you do – when you're in this situation where you're trying to get on the air with quick stuff, you do say, hey, it'll just take a second with – so was it – did the reporter probably sandbag him a little bit? They probably did. They couldn't get him on the air any other time on this subject. They took the opportunity. This is way over the line.
Yeah, and for a moment when I read the congressman's response afterwards about how essentially he was ambushed, that he was there to talk about the State of the Union speech, I thought, okay, I can understand that. And I'm not sure I would have used live television right after the speech as a way to hit him up with that question. On the other hand, it appears that might have been the only opportunity to get the congressman to talk about something that's been a big news story in New York. And as Jim said, this guy's got at least a record, according to some other media reports, of associating with some people who have some unsavory behaviors. It's not the first time he's gone off on other people, whether it's the media or colleagues or whatever. So,
what I find interesting about this is a former FBI agent, a former Marine who has come under fire from those two organizations for using the insignia and some of the signage that goes with being a part of those organizations in his campaign. This is a guy who could theoretically be perceived as intimidating in his own right. And I think we saw that very loud and clear.
I could imagine, 15 years ago that this is a story that would have been really interesting on Long Island or whatever, and that would have been about it. But it was just, it fit too perfectly the narrative, instead of just having this president and the standard Republican response. Well, here's a Republican response for you.
Which kind of leads to my next question, actually. Here's a Republican response for you, but it's one that went viral quickly because the station made a point of posting it very quickly to its website and spreading it out late into the evening and overnight hours through social media channels, was even on the news this morning locally here on our affiliates, shows up on the Today Show. New York One's reaction and how they took it and made it as public as they did, in your opinion, is that the approach, or is that using a bully pulpit to kind of amplify this and try to push public support in your way?
I think they had a right to be aggressive, especially in demanding an apology, essentially. I mean, it was just over the line. You don't threaten somebody whether you think the microphone is on or not. And I don't know all about the sort of social media promotion of it and all of that, but I think they had a right to seek an apology, and good for them.
And I don't think there's any question. I listened to the interview that they did this morning on New York One with the head of their political department, and he was upset and he was angry. He had a right to be so in the nature, not in the confrontation, but in the nature of the confrontation. He used the resources that he had at his disposal. You can say whether that's good or bad. I would say it's expected.
Okay. Our next topic is one I think all three of us, journalists who primarily work in digital spaces, will be watching pretty closely. Last week, CNN announced that mobile page views account for 40% of its web traffic. ESPN's traffic tipped over the 50% mobile threshold last year. A reporter from Pointer called up CNN's digital managing editor, Mizzou grad Meredith Artley, and asked her what this might mean in terms of strategy for the network. Would resources be directed toward the mobile web or toward app development? Artley said she doesn't get caught up in the rhetoric surrounding apps. Comparing it to a roller coaster, she thinks, is a red herring. What are you seeing in your research? What does this tell you? What do you think might be going on?
Well, I think you're going to see dual path. I think you're going to see both. The mobile web experience is rich for some types of experience, but I think increasingly news organizations, many of whom's content management system may be really serving mobile web anyway, are going to build out this sort of side path that is app-specific content, things like slideshows and five things to know, really quick-hitting content, because a lot of people are getting their information first in quick bites on a mobile device. That's where I think app optimizes and an app experience optimizes. The mobile web gives you a deeper, richer experience, maybe not on a phone, but on a tablet. So most news organizations, from the way that I look at this, Mike, are probably going to have to dual path it.
I think the difficulty, I agree with that. The difficulty is for those smaller news organizations that don't have the resources of CNN or the New York Times or the Guardian or whatever. I mean, they can afford to have a mobile web strategy that works across all platforms and to have the so-called walled garden app strategy. I mean, it is useful if you're CNN or the New York Times or one of those three or four news sites that I might actually use the app and go to all the time. If you're not one of those folks whose app is being looked at constantly throughout the day, investing your time and money in programming talent and building that may not be worth it. And there are lots of smaller news organizations that frankly could benefit from the values that mobile apps bring, but are never going to be able to get to the point where they can exploit it.
Okay. Sunday is advertising's biggest night. Or is it? Already, Super Bowl commercials are starting to leak out, like this one from Volkswagen.
What if I told you that every time a Volkswagen hits 100,000 miles, a German engineer gets his wings?
This is the full ad. You can see it online. And while others, like Wonderful Pistachios and M&M's, are releasing teasers, giving viewers an idea behind the joke without giving away the punchline before the big game. Fox is charging $4 million this year for some of those premium spots. There are advertisers that are paying for them. Is that a lot or a little?
I would suspect that it's a reallocation. It's a lot. I don't think there's any way to say that it isn't a lot because for 30 seconds, $4 million just seems like a lot, if for no other reason. But I think that maybe some of these brands are choosing to take what might be an everyday spend and cutting back on that, reallocating that, maybe taking more control of that. They're not going to miss an opportunity like the Super Bowl. And I think there's probably maybe crazily room to grow in that 4 million number.
It does look like that some of these bigger advertisers are figuring out that there's more to deciding whether the Super Bowl should be a venue for you than just lots and lots of eyeballs. I mean, you see some of the advertisers that have been on the Super Bowl for a while backing out, some new ones coming in because it's tied to a specific strategy.
Any examples?
Well, Chevrolet, for example, hasn't been on the Super Bowl for a couple of years, and now they're coming back with, I think, a couple of ads because they have some new product lines that they're trying to promote. And so it makes sense for them. Or you have some folks who are coming in, you know, again, trying to introduce a new product or trying to resurrect an old one. I noticed M&M's, for example, is going to bring back the peanut character. And they're doing that because, strangely enough, they're trying to make a case that the peanuts in the M&M's are somehow part of a healthy food trend.
There's protein.
I don't know about that. But it is interesting because you can't just make that decision, even if you've got that kind of money to spend. Yeah. You can't make it in isolation now because there's so many other big events that are within the made-for-TV events in the next few months. Olympics, the Grammys we just had, the Oscars, which are just coming up. So you've got to figure out, you know, which of those target audiences you need to reach with your advertising dollar.
And it's interesting because they often say that the Oscars are the Super Bowl for women, if you will, that there are different audiences to reach through each of these different periods.
I think the other thing that you're going to start to see is just more responsiveness in these ads and more tailoring and more customization and all of that. As much as news media is going through a transformation, I believe the advertising end of this is also going through a similar transition of how do we capture the best audience at the best time. And I think they're looking at this all holistically.
I'll be curious to see what happens with the David Beckham ad. He's for H&M, I believe it is. He's going to be advertising his underwear line, and people who have Samsung smart TVs will be able to buy that product directly with their remote control while watching the commercial. We'll see if that works.
Yeah, we'll see if that works for sure. Well, that music means we're just about out of time. I'd like to thank you for spending the past half hour with us. If you'd like to learn more about any of the stories Mike, Jim, and I talked about today, visit our links blog. You can find that under the Talk Shows tab at kbia.org. You can also replay the show and leave comments for us there, or send us an email at views@kbia.org. And new this week, look for us on Facebook. If you like us on the radio and TV, you'll like us there too. Or give us a follow on Twitter. We're at views@kbia. Many thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and KBIA's Pat Akers for handling the audio. Josie Herrera is our associate producer. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to listen in next week when Mike, Jim, and I will have another edition of Views of the News.